Chapter 134. A Vagabond Chapter. We must pass over a part of Mrs. Rebecca Crawley's biography with that lightness and delicacy which the world demands, the moral world, that has, perhaps, no particular objection to vice, but an insuperable repugnance to hearing vice called by its proper name. There are things we do, and know perfectly well in Vanity Fair, though we never speak of them. As the Aromanians worship the devil, but don't mention him. And a polite public will no more bear to read an authentic description of vice than a truly refined English or American female will permit the word breeches to be pronounced in her chaste hearing. And yet, madam, both are walking the world before our faces every day, without much shocking us. If he were to blush every time they went by, what complexions he would have. It is only when their naughty names are called out that your modesty has any occasion to show alarm or sense of outrage, and it has been the wish of the present writer, all through this story, deferentially to submit to the fashion at present prevailing, and only to hint at the existence of wickedness in a light, easy, and agreeable manner, so that nobody's fine feelings may be offended. I defy anyone to say that our Becky, who has certainly some vices, has not been presented to the public in a perfectly genteel and inoffensive manner. In describing this siren, singing, and smiling, coaxing, and cajoling, the author, with modest pride, asks his readers all round, has he once forgotten the laws of politeness, and showed the monster's hideous tail above water? No. Those who like may peep down under waves that are pretty transparent, and see it writhing and twirling, diabolically hideous and slimy, flapping amongst bones, or curling round corpses. But above the waterline, I ask, has not everything been proper, agreeable, and decorous, and has any the most squeamish immoralist in Vanity Fair a right to cry fie? When, however, the siren disappears and dives below, down among the dead men, the water of course grows turbid over her, and it is labor lost to look into it ever so curiously. They look pretty enough when they sit upon a rock, twanging their harps and combing their hair, and sing, and beckon to you to come, and hold the looking glass. But when they sink into their native element, depend on it, those mermaids are about no good, and we had best not examine the fiendish marine cannibals, reveling and feasting on their wretched pickled victims. And so, when Becky is out of the way, be sure that she is not particularly well employed, and that the less that is said about her doings is in fact the better. If we were to give a full account of her proceedings during a couple of years that followed after the Curzon Street catastrophe, there might be some reason for people to say this book was improper. The actions of very vain, heartless, pleasure-seeking people are very often improper, as are many of yours, my friend with the grave face and spotless reputation. But that is merely by the way, and what are those of a woman without faith or love or character? And I am inclined to think that there was a period in Mrs. Becky's life when she was seized, not by remorse, but by a kind of despair, and absolutely neglected her person, and did not even care for her reputation. This abatement and degradation did not take place all at once. It was brought about by degrees, after her calamity, and after many struggles, to keep up as a man who goes overboard hangs onto a spar, whilst any hope is left, and then flings it away and goes down, when he finds that struggling is in vain. She lingered about London, whilst her husband, and was making preparations for his departure to his seat of government, and it is believed made more than one attempt to see her brother-in-law, Sir Pitt Crawley, and to work upon his feelings, which as he had almost enlisted in her favor. As Sir Pitt and Mr. Wenham were walking down to the House of Commons, the latter spied Mrs. Rawdon in a black veil, and lurking near the palace of the legislature. She sneaked away when her eyes met those of Wenham, and indeed never succeeded in her designs upon the baronet. Probably Lady Jane interposed. I have heard that she quite astonished her husband by the spirit which he exhibited in this quarrel, and her determination to disown Mrs. Becky. of her own movement, she invited Rodin to come and stop in Gaunt Street until his departure for Coventry Island, knowing that with him for a guard Mrs. Becky would not try to force her door, and she looked curiously at the superscriptions of all the letters which arrived for Sir Pitt, lest he and his sister-in-law should be corresponding. Not but that Rebecca could have written had she a mind, but she did not try to see, or to write to Pitt at his own house, and after one or two attempts consented to his demand, that the correspondence regarding her conjugal differences should be carried on by lawyers only. The fact was that Pitt's mind had been poisoned against her. A short time after Lord Steyne's accident, Wenham had been with the baronet, and given him such a biography of Mrs. Becky as had astonished the member for Queen's Crawley. He knew everything regarding her. Who her father was, in what year her mother danced at the opera, what had been her previous history, and what her conduct during her married life, as I have no doubt that the greater part of the story was false and dictated by interested malevolence, it shall not be repeated here. But Becky was left with a sad, sad reputation in the esteem of a country gentleman and relative who had been once rather partial to her. The revenues of the governor of Coventry Island are not large. A part of them were set aside by His Excellency for the payment of certain outstanding debts and liabilities. The charges incident on his high situation required considerable expense. Finally, it was found that he could not spare to his wife more than £300 a year, which he proposed to pay to her on an undertaking that she would never trouble him. Otherwise, scandal, separation, doctors' commons would ensue. But it was Mr. Wenham's business, Lord Steyne's business, Rawdon's, everybody's to get her out of the country and hush up a most disagreeable affair. She was probably so much occupied in arranging these affairs of business with her husband's lawyers that she forgot to take any step whatever about her son, the little Rawdon, and did not even once propose to go and see him. That young gentleman was consigned to the entire guardianship of his aunt and uncle, the former of whom had always possessed a great share of the child's affection. His mama wrote him a neat letter from Bowlin, when she quitted England, in which she requested him to mind his book, and said she was going to take a continental tour, during which she would have the pleasure of writing to him again. But she never did for a year afterwards, and not, indeed, until Sir Pitt's only boy, always sickly, died of whooping cough and measles. Then Rawdon's mama wrote the most affectionate composition to her darling son, who was made heir of Queen's Crawley by this accident, and drawn more closely than ever to the kind lady, whose tender heart had already adopted him. Rawdon Crawley, then grown a tall, fine lad, blushed when he got the letter. "H, Aunt Jane, you are my mother," he said, and not that one. But he wrote back a kind and respectful letter to Mrs. Rebecca, then living at a boarding house at Florence. But we are advancing matters. Our darling Becky's first flight was not very far. She perched upon the French coast at Bowlin, that refuge of so much exiled English innocence, and there lived in rather a genteel, widowed manner, with a femme de chambre and a couple of rooms, at an hotel. She dined at the table d'hôte, where people thought her very pleasant, and where she entertained her neighbors by stories of her brother, Sir Pitt, and her great London acquaintance, talking that easy fashionable slip-slop which has so much effect upon certain folks of small breeding. She passed with many of them for a person of importance. She gave little tea parties in her private room, and shared in the innocent amusements of the place in sea bathing, and in jaunts in open carriages, in strolls on the sands, and in visits to the play. Mrs. Burgess, the printer's lady, who was boarding with her family at the hotel for the summer, and to whom her Burgess came of a Saturday and Sunday, voted her charming, until that little rogue of a Burgess began to pay her too much attention. But there was nothing in the story, only that Becky was always affable, easy, and good-natured, and with men especially. Numbers of people were going abroad as usual at the end of the season, and Becky had plenty of opportunities of finding out by the behavior of her acquaintances of the great London world the opinion of society as regarded her conduct. One day it was Lady Partlet and her daughters whom Becky confronted as she was walking modestly on Bowland Pier, the cliffs of Albion shining in the distance across the deep blue sea. Lady Partlet marshaled all her daughters round her with a sweep of her parasol and retreated from the pier, darting savage glances at poor little Becky who stood alone there. On another day the packet came in. It had been blowing fresh, and it always suited Becky's humor to see the droll woe-begone faces of the people as they emerged from the boat. Lady Slingstone happened to be on board this day. Her ladyship had been exceedingly ill in her carriage, and was greatly exhausted, and scarcely fit to walk up the plank from the ship to the pier. But all her energies rallied the instant she saw Becky smiling roguishly under a pink bonnet, and giving her a glance of scorn such as would have shriveled up most women, she walked into the custom house quite unsupported. Becky only laughed. But I don't think she liked it. She felt she was alone, quite alone, and the far-off shining cliffs of England were impassable to her. The behavior of the men had undergone to I don't know what change. Grinstone showed his teeth and laughed in her face with a familiarity that was not pleasant. Little Bob Suckling, who was cap in hand to her 3 months before, and would walk a mile in the rain to see for her carriage in the line at Gaunt House, was talking to Fitzhugh of the guards, Lord Hee-haw's son, one day upon the jetty, as Becky took her walk there. Little Bobby nodded to her over his shoulder, without moving his hat, and continued his conversation with the air of hee-haw. Tom Rakes tried to walk into her sitting room at the inn with a cigar in his mouth, but she closed the door upon him, and would have locked it, only that his fingers were inside. She began to feel that she was very lonely indeed. If he'd been here, she said, those cowards would never have dared to insult me. She thought about him with great sadness, and perhaps longing about his honest, stupid, constant kindness and fidelity, his never-ceasing obedience, his good humor, his bravery and courage. Very likely she cried, for she was particularly lively, and had put on a little extra rouge when she came down to dinner. She rouged regularly now. And her maid got cognac for her besides that which was charged in the hotel bill. Perhaps the insults of the men were not, however, so intolerable to her as the sympathy of certain women. Mrs. Crackenberry and Mrs. Washington White passed through Bowland on their way to Switzerland. The party were protected by Colonel Horner, young Bomeris, and of course old Crackenberry, and Mrs. White's little girl. They did not avoid her. They giggled, cackled, tattled, condoled, consoled, and patronized her until they drove her almost wild with rage. To be patronized by them, she thought, as they went away simpering after kissing her. And she heard Bomeris's laugh ringing on the stair, and knew quite well how to interpret his hilarity. It was after this visit that Becky, who had paid her weekly bills, Becky who had made herself agreeable to everybody in the house, who smiled at the landlady, called the waiters on sewer, and paid the chambermaids in politeness and apologies, what far more than compensated for a little niggardliness in point of money of which Becky never was free, that Becky, we say, received a notice to quit from the landlord, who had been told by someone that she was quite an unfit person to have at his hotel, where English ladies would not sit down with her. And she was forced to fly into lodgings, of which the dullness and solitude were most wearisome to her. Still she held up, in spite of these rebuffs, and tried to make a character for herself and conquer scandal. She went to church very regularly, and sang louder than anybody there. She took up the cause of the widows of the shipwrecked fishermen, and gave work and drawings for the Quashaboo Mission. She subscribed to the assembly and wouldn't waltz. In a word, she did everything that was respectable, and that is why we dwell upon this part of her career with more fondness than upon subsequent parts of her history, which are not so pleasant. She saw people avoiding her, and still laboriously smiled upon them, You never could suppose from her countenance what pangs of humiliation she might be enduring inwardly. Her history was after all a mystery. Parties were divided about her. Some people who took the trouble to busy themselves in the matter said that she was the criminal, whilst others vowed that she was as innocent as a lamb, and that her odious husband, and was in fault. She won over a good many by bursting into tears about her boy, and exhibiting the most frantic grief when his name was mentioned, or she saw anybody like him. She gained good Mrs. Alderney's heart in that way, who was rather the queen of British bowling, and gave the most dinners and balls of all the residents there, by weeping when Master Alderney came from Dr. Swishtail's academy to pass his holidays with his mother. He and her Auden were of the same age, and so like, Becky said in a voice choking with agony, whereas there was 5 years difference between the boys' ages, and no more likeness between them than between my respected reader and his humble servant. When he was going abroad, on his way to Kissingen to join Lord Stan, enlightened Mrs. Alderney on this point, and told her how he was much more able to describe little Rodden than his mama, who notoriously hated him, and never saw him, how he was 13 years old, while little Alderney was but 9, fair, while the other darling was dark in a word, caused the lady in question to repent of her good humor. Whenever Becky made a little circle for herself with incredible toils and labor, somebody came and swept it down rudely, and she had all her work to begin over again. It was very hard, very hard, lonely and disheartening. There was Mrs. Newbright, who took her up for some time, attracted by the sweetness of her singing at church, and by her proper views upon serious subjects, concerning which in former days, at Queen's Crawley, Mrs. Becky had had a good deal of instruction. Well, she not only took tracts, but she read them. She worked flannel petticoats for the Quashaboos, cotton nightcaps for the Coconut Indians, painted hand screens for the conversion of the Pope, and the Jews sat under Mr. Rowles on Wednesdays, Mr. Huggleton on Thursdays, attended 2 Sunday services at church, besides Mr. Baller, the Derbyite, in the evening, and all in vain. Mrs. Newbright had occasion to correspond with the Countess of Southdown about the warming pan fund for the Fiji Islanders for the management, of which admirable charity both these ladies formed part of a female committee, and having mentioned her wheat friend, Mrs. Rodden Crawley, the Dowager Countess wrote back such a letter regarding Becky, with such particulars, hints, facts, falsehoods, and general combinations, that intimacy between Mrs. Newbright and Mrs. Crawley ceased forthwith, and all the serious world of Tours, where this misfortune took place, immediately parted company with the reprobate. Those who know the English colonies abroad know that we carry with us our pride, pills, prejudices, Harvey sauces, cayenne peppers, and other lairs, making a little Britain wherever we settle down. From one colony to another Becky fled uneasily. From Bowlin to Deep, from Deep to Keen, from Keen to Tour, trying with all her might to be respectable, and alas, all was found out some day or other, and pecked out of the cage by the real Dawes. Mrs. Hook Eagles took her up at one of these places, a woman without a blemish in her character, and a house in Portman Square. She was staying at the hotel at Deep, whither Becky fled, and they made each other's acquaintance first at sea, where they were swimming together, and subsequently at the table d'hote of the hotel. Mrs. Eagles had heard, who indeed had not, some of the scandal of the Stan affair, but after a conversation with Becky, she pronounced that Mrs. Crawley was an angel, her husband a ruffian, Lord Stan an unprincipled wretch, as everybody knew, and the whole case against Mrs. Crawley an infamous and wicked conspiracy of that rascal Wenham. If you were a man of any spirit, Mr. Eagles, you would box the wretch's ears the next time you see him at the club, she said to her husband. But Eagles was only a quiet old gentleman, husband to Mrs. Eagles, with a taste for geology, and not tall. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.